Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, March 4th, 2007, on WILL AM 580. Today, perhaps, in the long list of wonderful guests we've had on the program, one of our most wonderful, one we've been wanting for a very long time, Robert Fisk, legendary Middle East correspondent for The Independent, well-known to many of you and should be well-known to the rest of you an hour from now, will be joining us live on the air. Robert Fisk, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A funny thing happened on the Federal Communications Commission's way to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania last month. It came to town to hold the third of its six promised public hearings on media ownership. However, it did not announce the venue for the meeting until just a few days before Friday, February 23rd, and scheduled it for the early morning. But somehow, Harrisburg area television and radio stations managed to mobilize en masse for the public testimony part of the meeting, which featured droves of employees touting the charity of their employers and representatives of area charities gushing with gratitude about how local media outlets help them raise money through free airtime. Something seemed fishy about the lopsided praise, according to Elizabeth Hainstack.
Apparently, I came to the wrong meeting. I was expecting to be at a conference or a forum that was about media ownership and about the fact that we people own the licenses. Instead, I seem to be at a forum that is self-serving, embarrassing, humiliating about the television stations in this area coming here and stacking the deck and speaking before all of us had a chance about how wonderful they are in this area when they're only doing their job.
Interestingly enough, noted Daniel Brook, who was not paid to be there and instead took the day off work to testify, the platitudes for local media in central Pennsylvania did not translate into demand for further concentration.
There were speakers speaking in favor of all of the wonderful things that the media conglomerates have done for the local community, but none of them listed any reasons why greater media consolidation would boost that activity. I would submit it's because there are no reasons.
Linda Foley, president of the Newspaper Guild, CWA, and a Pennsylvania native, didn't disparage the praise for local media, but instead suggested it may be a bit misplaced.
That's all very, very good, and I'm very pleased to hear it, but it's not a substitute for aggressive news coverage and competition, which is really what media in this country and the rule and the laws that we have in this country to promote a free and open media are supposed to do, is to inform the citizenry of what's going on.
The same week as the hearing in Harrisburg, hundreds packed an auditorium in Burlington, Vermont to sound off in a public hearing on media ownership hosted by Senator Bernie Sanders. They complained mostly about flashy news coverage lacking substance and the illusion of choice perpetuated by hundreds of cable TV channels, which just happened to be owned by the same half dozen major conglomerates. In addition to the handful of official public hearings on the subject, free press and public interest organizations around the country are organizing several town meetings on the future of U.S. media ownership. The next one takes place on March 7th in Columbus, Ohio. This will be the first informal public meeting of its kind to feature a bipartisan majority of the FCC in attendance. Democrats Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps and Republican Robert McDowell have all committed to the Columbus event. Learn more about the future of media town meetings and how to file your own testimony on media ownership with the FCC online by visiting www.stopbigmedia.com.
Over the last few years, tens of thousands of journalists and other staff at newspapers around the country have lost their jobs due to cost-cutting by corporate owners who seek to increase their paper's profit margins and make their stockholders happy. But a new study of newspapers produced by the University of Missouri's School of Journalism reports that companies who invest in their newsrooms are actually more likely to make better money over the long run. The research involved analyzing 10 years of financial information from papers around the country. It found that while cuts in the newsroom did have an effect on short-term profit margins, the long-term decline in quality that comes from cutting the heart out of a newspaper, its ability to actually gather news, is much more costly to the bottom line, especially when readers flee to more substantive alternatives.
Although proposals to cut the funding for public broadcasting are again circulating in Congress, the implications of a cut that would do away with as much as a quarter of all federal money for public TV and radio haven't really been thought through. But a new report from the Government Accountability Office says such a drastic cut to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's bottom line would all but force its commercialization. The GAO surveyed several dozen public TV stations and found that more than half said the proposed cuts, were they to come to pass, would definitely result in loss of staff and programming. Nearly a dozen stations said they'd probably have to go off the air if they lost any more federal support. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live March 4th, 2007. Today, we're very privileged to have as our guest one of the outstanding journalists one of the great correspondents, former correspondents of our times as well, Robert Fisk, the journalist, the correspondent for The Independent, who's been covering the Middle East now for decades, author of numerous books, including the classic Pity the Nation, as well as recent The Great War for Civilization. Robert Fisk is joining us on the telephone from New York City, where he is in the United States on a brief trip. Tonight, by the way, Robert Fisk will be appearing in New York, for those of you listening on the internet, at Town Hall, 7 p.m. this evening, 123 West 43rd Street. Robert Fisk, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you.
Well, there's certainly a lot happening on your beat nowadays. And I think for the sake of our listeners, if we could start with the war in Iraq, which is the number one political issue in the United States today, if you could, if there was something about Iraq you would like to communicate to most Americans that they might not be familiar with from their news media coverage, what would it be?
I think there's an awful lot that you're not familiar with from your coverage here in the United States. Well, I suppose the first thing is that we seem to have plunged into Iraq without looking at recent history. You know, the British occupied Iraq in 1917, in very much the same way as the Americans and British did again in 2003. We even published a declaration when our British army reached Baghdad saying we'd come to liberate the people of Iraq. We weren't conquerors, we were liberators, to give them freedom after generations of tyranny, which sounds fairly familiar now, doesn't it? Then an insurgency started against the British occupation army in 1920. We besieged a town called Fallujah. We besieged a town called Najaf. British intelligence reported to London in 1920 that terrorists were crossing the border from Syria into Iraq. The British Prime Minister of the time, 1920, Lloyd George, stood up in the British Houses of Parliament and said, if we leave Iraq now, there will be civil war. It's like a fingerprint copy of what happened in 2003 up to now. We didn't read our history books, or if we read it, we didn't care about history. Mistake number one, and number one, what we really didn't think about or know about the war. I think what I'd say is that, you know, the greatest folly of this war, which is obviously a disaster for the United States and a much greater disaster for Iraq, for the Iraqis themselves in terms of human lives, is that we told a lot of lies about the Iraqi connection to 9/11, which didn't exist, weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. And when we went on and believed that the insurgency were what Paul Bremer III, the second U.S. proconsul in Baghdad, referred to as remnants, dead-enders, Saddamites, when in fact quite the contrary. It was a blossoming, dangerous, real insurgency. And we seem, in a way, to be behaving in Iraq and also in Afghanistan on the basis that we've come to believe in our own lies, which is a terribly dangerous thing to do, to actually act on the basis of lies, which we know to be lies. We keep saying, oh, we're winning in Iraq. There's going to be democracy. We're winning in Afghanistan, when quite clearly we are not. My colleague Patrick Coburn was reporting from Iraq, where I also report from, not long ago, and he said, in reference to our own dear Prime Minister Tony Blair, one of the most frustrating things about dealing with the lies of the British Prime Minister is that to prove him wrong, i.e. that there is anarchy, not peace, you have to go to Iraq and get your throat cut, because, of course, it's too dangerous to report. One of the things you need to realize is that when you see these datelines in the New York Times and the Washington Post saying Baghdad, almost invariably, not always, but almost invariably, unless these reporters are embedded with the U.S. military, they're reporting from a hotel room with a mobile phone. They are not out on the streets. But the Dateline Baghdad gives the impression that the journalists are going out and checking the story out and checking what the Americans say about an air raid on a village. They can't do that, and they don't do that. I call this hotel journalism. Understandable, but we're not told that in the reports. And indeed, the whole idea that Iraq can be saved by surges or spikes or whatever the cliche is nonsense. It is a hell disaster for the people who live there. It is a disaster in terms of the whole American project for the Middle East. And we watch this place disintegrating. And indeed, as I always write in my newspaper, you know, the Americans must leave, the Americans will leave, and the Americans can't leave for all the reasons we know. And that is, unfortunately, the equation that turns sand into blood. It is a disaster. It is a terrible tragedy. And there is no, I'm looking for the usual cliches, light at the end of the tunnel does not exist. It's pretty grim.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Robert Fisk, correspondent for the Independent, Mideast correspondent, is author of many books, including the recent The Great War for Civilization, also Pity the Nation. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Fisk. You can find his work in The Independent online. Just Google the name Robert Fisk and Independent, you'll get it. Robert Fisk is also the Lannan Lifetime Achievement Prize winner for cultural freedom, quite an honor. And he will be speaking, for those of you listening on the Internet in the New York area tonight, in New York City, 123 West 43rd Street at the Town Hall, 7 p.m. This evening. You know, Robert Fisk, one of the things that Democrats in the United States like to say as they oppose the current war in Iraq is while the Iraq war was a clunker, the Afghanistan war they supported, and that was the right kind of war for the United States to be engaged in the Middle East, going after the Taliban, and that war, by comparison, is a success. What is your assessment of the U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and how successful it's been?
Well, it's certainly not a success. I mean, you have to realize, in a way, Afghanistan is two countries. In the north and in Kabul itself, there's a comparative peace. Of course, areas of that territory are run by the warlords, who, of course, were involved in the civil war, which cost so many lives after the Soviets left in 1990. But this is the southern part of Afghanistan, the Pashtun areas, particularly around Kandahar, are frankly outside all government control. If you go to Kandahar city itself, you don't see U.S. troops driving through. You don't see British troops driving through. They keep to their base. They go out on these patrols, these dangerous patrols, and they bomb villages and put up patrols into villages and decide they're going to defend the local mayor in a local village in Helmand province, and then they get surrounded. There was a very sinister, in a way, rather dangerous message came from the British Defense Ministry some weeks ago, where they said that British troops were now fighting in Afghanistan on a scale they hadn't done since Korea. And I remember thinking, Korea, now hold on a second, why are they choosing Korea? And of course, just as the U.S. Marines in Korea and the Gloucestershire Regiment of the British Army in Korea, what happened in that long-distant war is that the Chinese crossed the Yalu River and by sheer force of numbers overwhelmed the U.N. troops, who were primarily American and British and Australian and so on. And what's happening in the villages of Helmand is that small 12-man units of the British Army are almost being overwhelmed by hundreds of armed Taliban fighters. Then we come out with these various phrases like, oh, the Taliban have come across the border, the foreigners are coming across the border. But, of course, the Taliban are Afghans for the most part. They live in Afghanistan. It's their country. We may not like that. We may not like the fact. We may, we may think that their rule is outrageous and hideous and Middle Ages and cruel and so on. And in some ways it certainly has been and would be. But the fact of the matter is, I think it's a pretty unwinnable war. Let's go back to history again. I've got a very dear friend of mine gave me the official British inquiry into the loss of a British brigade at a battle called Maywand in 1880. And if you read that inquiry, there's a British officer called Captain Mannering talking about how people called Taliban, were overwhelming British troops, the British grenadiers, pulling them out of the ranks and knifing them to death and chopping their heads off. Nothing changes, you could say. What on earth are we doing in Afghanistan? We're not really able to prop up the government down there in Kandahar. We can't hold the territory. We're destroying a lot of villages. Clearly, a lot of civilians are being killed. Sometimes we admit it, sometimes we don't. We're now told that NATO is going to beat the Taliban before there's a spring offensive. There seems to be an offensive going on all through the winter. And again, you see, journalists cannot move freely around those southern parts of Afghanistan because they will be killed. So in a sense, you see, you can keep on. And that, I think, is how the West rather likes this. We don't want our reporters wandering around finding out that our optimistic forecasts are not correct. People in Iraq as well as Afghanistan, they deserve some democracy. They deserve some packages of human rights off our Western supermarket shelves. They would like some democracy, but they also want a different kind of freedom, I think, and that's freedom from us, and this we do not obviously intend to give them.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Robert Fisk, our foreign correspondent for the Independent Middle East Correspondent. He's in the United States briefly per se, so we're very fortunate to have him on the program with us. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Robert Fisk, the telephone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Before I go to the phone lines, let me say that we did have one caller who wanted to know when the next pledge drive for Media Matters would be, and that will be on April 1st. So I think that's approximately 4 weeks from today will be the next pledge drive for Media Matters. Please stay tuned and call in then. But today, please make your calls for Robert Fisk or just sit back and listen and enjoy the program. Let's go to line one now, Champagne. You are on the air with Robert Fisk.
Hey, is it okay if we talk about media consolidation?
Certainly. Hopefully it'll have some connection to what Robert Fisk will say.
Well, he can say whatever he wants. I assume he'll be too chicken to answer the question. But why is it that views like yours get a state subsidy and views of conservatives and Republicans have to, you know, sell advertising and, you know, get customers and that sort of stuff? Why is it – I mean, I've traveled this country wildly, and I have the little whim.
Hello? Through no fault of ours, the caller seems to have been cut off. Robert Fisk, are you there?
Yeah, I'm certainly here. I'm certainly not the person who can answer that question because I haven't the slightest idea how you subsidize radio stations in the United States. I live in Beirut, not in New York.
Yeah, I don't think that's a question we'll take next time.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a good question, but I'm not the right person to ask it of.
No, I'm well aware of that. Let's go back, if we can, till the phone lines come in again, to another question that's commonly posited on American television by commentators, which is that the core problem facing the United States and the West in Afghanistan and Iraq and in the entire region is the nature of Islam itself. This is a religion that is incorrigible and is incapable of really adapting to modern society. I suspect you've heard that argument before.
Yeah, I hear it from both directions, too. I'm also told that, you know, the Western ideology can't adapt itself to any other culture but its own, so it goes in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I think the thing is this, before you start, you know, going to Islam as a religion, and I'm not sure, you know, we know as much about Christianity necessarily as we know about Islam these days, let's just remember something. Western forces, who would probably call themselves Christians if they have a religion, are in some form or another, air bases, helicopters, mountain divisions, you name it, special forces, are now in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Jordan, Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, still in Saudi Arabia, Oman, in Algeria, in the southern Sahara, near Taman Rafet. We have this huge amounts of military equipment and weapons and soldiers all across the Islamic world. There are no Egyptian soldiers in New York City. There's no Jordanian soldiers occupying London. There's no Turkish soldiers occupying Paris. And yet we turn around and say that their religion is incorrigible and cannot coalesce with anyone else. So what are we doing in their countries if we find them so inimical? And so if we find Islam such an unpleasant or alien religion to us, why are we there? That's what Muslims ask me, by the way. And it's very difficult to find a reply because we don't usually think about it that way around. Look, I don't think you can say, look, it's about a religion. This is not a religious war, even if it's turned out that nationalism has given way to Islamicism, because people have given up in the Middle East political, ideological ways of struggling and have turned back to the basics of what we all do in terms when we feel frightened or we feel oppressed, they turn to their religion. But it's not a question of what the Prophet Muhammad taught or what God says in the Quran or what God says in the Bible. Frankly, if you go through the Torah or the Bible or the Quran or the Hadith, the sayings of the prophets, you can find excuses to murder and massacre tens of thousands of people. We've got to try and live in a world of human rights. Some Arab states do try, some don't. Some don't want to. Some, like Saddam's Iraq before, and some, like Egypt, they're not interested in human rights at all. But I think this is not an issue about religion. It's an issue about justice. And another thing that needs to be said, you know, is that it's not a question of dumping all this on the United States either. America is capable, in the right hands, with the right policies, with the idea of justice, rather than ideological neoconservative projects in mind, are doing great good in the Middle East and throughout the world. You know, I often point out that after the First World War, when we Westerners created the modern Middle East and chopped up all the tribes and peoples and made all these artificial borders, and we created Jordan and we created Palestine and we created Lebanon and so on, at that time, American diplomats in the Middle East, consuls to the dying Ottoman Empire, and NGOs who were called missionaries then, they all petitioned the U.S. State Department and the U.S. President, who was Woodrow Wilson, to create one modern Arab democratic state stretching from the Atlantic coast of Morocco all the way to the border between what was then called Mesopotamia and Persia, what today we'd call Iraq and Iran. And it would have been a wonderful idea to have fulfilled. And the Americans were quite keen on it, even though Woodrow Wilson was dying, and then, of course, America slipped into isolationism. And it was the British and French, the conquerors of the First World War, through the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was signed in secret between us without even the Americans knowing, which chopped up the Middle East and made this aspiration impossible. So, you know, if you're going to look around, I don't think you blame Islam any more than you blame Christianity. You've got to look at history and what we Europeans did at a time when I think the Americans could have done a lot with the Middle East. Now, of course, a different set of issues has come into play, and now, of course, Israel has got to be the number one country in U.S. foreign policy, as we know it is, whether it should be or not is a different matter. And, of course, therefore, the idea of America being an even-handed middle negotiator is almost impossible to fulfill. So we have more problems there. But you know, I don't think this is about Islam. You can go around in Islamic societies or Muslim societies and find many things wrong with them. I can tell you straight away. I mean, I think that in most Muslim countries, the treatment of women is either abominable or certainly totally unjust. I don't think that can really be justified by the Quran because of the period and the time the Quran was written, for example. You know, women were in much greater servitude than they were after the advent of Islam. On the other hand, if you go to the Middle East, you'll find many things about that Islamic society which are praiseworthy. When an elderly mother or father or grandmother or grandfather is dying, they are not farmed out to nursing homes and visited once a week by loving relatives. They're kept at home and looked after by their families, and they stay at the home where they grew up and lived, and they're looked after and they die in their homes, looked after and loved by their families. How different from our society in the West, where in Britain, for example, and I know in the States, when people become infirm, they're very often, they have to leave their homes and go into much more anonymous circumstances where they die and are visited occasionally by their families. There's an example, for instance, of a very merciful and loving society towards their families, which doesn't exist so much in the West. That doesn't mean we denigrate the West with all the tremendous advances and humanitarian causes that we go for. But this idea that Islam is an incorrigible religion, this goes back to the kind of cartoons that were published, not in Danish newspapers, but in 15th century Spain. They were running the kind of cartoons that says Islam is incorrigible, the prophet never told the truth, there is no Muslim God, etc., etc. You can't do that. I mean, religions are meant to support people's ideas and spirits and spiritual aspirations. To go around saying, well, we don't like this bit of the Quran is the same as going around like saying we don't like this bit of the Bible. These are historical documents which you have to interpret for yourself.
Our guest today, Robert Fisk. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We do have phone lines open. The number here, 333-9455. Excuse me, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Robert Fisk is the Mideast correspondent for The Independent in London, and he's in the United States for a very brief trip. He'll be speaking in New York City tonight at Town Hall at 7 p.m. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Robert Fisk.
Hi, a question about your home area, the Lebanon. I rarely hear the discussion of this impasse in terms of the confessional system that the Constitution imposes. And with the current impasse, I don't know how one can get past that, but to even breathe a word about democracy in the Middle East, it seems that you have to get rid of this 50% rule. That might take a while. I don't know. I wanted to know if you also these revelations about the U.S. supporting what are called Sunni extremists in the Lebanon. There's three different groups that Hirsch is alleging are in some way getting money through the Sinhalese government or maybe directly from the Saudis. I wanted you to reflect on those things. If you
okay. Would. Well, let's go first of all to the confessional system in Lebanon. It is a fact, and this was something that the French, when they were running Lebanon as the mandate under the League of Nations after the First World War, the French produced Lebanon is run on the basis that the president of Lebanon must always be a Christian Maronite, the prime minister must always be a Sunni Muslim, the speaker of parliament must always be a Shiite Muslim. Thus, it is a confessional sectarian system of government, even though the Christians are now maybe only 35% of the population. And the Shiites, though they're not half the population, are certainly larger than the Christians. They still can only be head of parliament. So you've got a sectarian system of government, which means that Lebanon can never be a modern state. Just think of it. You grow up with tremendous attributes. You have a fantastic education. You're capable of becoming the president. But unfortunately, you're a Sunni Muslim, so you can only become the prime minister. What a system. Now, the only way of becoming a modern state is to just trash the conventional system and start again. But if you do that and you become a modern state, you see, it won't be Lebanon anymore, because the whole identity of Lebanon is based on these different confessional groups, Sunni Muslim, Shiite Muslim, Armenian Orthodox, Armenian Catholic, Maronite, et cetera, and Protestants too, and Kurdish Sunnis and so on. So it's almost impossible to break out of the confessional system that the French created in Lebanon without destroying Lebanon. Now, on that basis, you have a system where the moment one group pulls out of government, in this case the Shiites, which is the largest community in Lebanon, though of course not the majority, you end up in a situation where the sectarian government now no longer represents, because the Shiite ministers have pulled out, the largest community in the country. And what we've got, as usual in Lebanon, as always happens, the regional and major superpowers take sides. The Americans and the Israelis, in one form or another, support the status quo of Fuad Senora's Sunni Christian government. The Iranians and the Syrians support the Hezbollah, which undoubtedly is favored by most of the Shiites, though not all, and is also allied to a group of Christians, oddly enough, Christian Maronites, run by an ex-general called Michel Aoun. And you see, the whole thing is played out on the basis that now, if you read the AP wire, it'll always say the American-backed Lebanese government of Fuad Senora. In the Middle East at the moment, no one wants to be called American-backed, whether that's true or not. And then the Hezbollah is always represented, or the opposition to the government is always represented as being a tool of Iran, and thus wanting a coup d'etat. And so Lebanon cracks apart, splits apart, the old wounds are torn open again between Sunnis and Shias and some Christians and other Christians, and poor old Lebanon suffers while the rest of us go tut, tut, tut and wag our fingers and say, are Sunni groups getting money from Senora's government and thus indirectly from the United States? Look, Seymour Hersh, I've read his article, of course, in The New Yorker, and he's an old mate of mine. I admire him very much. He knew we were going to go to war in Iraq when I didn't think we would. So when Seymour Hersh says we're going to go to war with Iran, I'm very loath to contradict him, though I still don't think we are. However, we're talking about Lebanon. I read the article. Look, I think that any time you start pumping money into the Middle East to support one group against another, a lot of that money is going to end up in the hands of violent men, whether they be Shiites or Sunnis or Christians or whatever they may be. America pours money into Israel, which goes and American weapons into Israel, which are used against the Lebanese. The money from Iran pays for weapons for the Hezbollah. Lots of the American money, which was put forward as gifts under the Paris Three Agreement, is undoubtedly going to go towards the Lebanese army, 60% of whom, by the way, are Shiite Muslim. Now, does money go to these various groups, which are also supported by the Saudis? I doubt it directly, but indirectly money moves around Lebanon. There's the black market economy in the Middle East. Of course, they all benefit. After all, didn't Osama bin Laden work effectively for the West and the CIA's money against the Soviet Union when the Russians were occupying Afghanistan? Of course he did. Didn't the Americans supply weapons to Iran in part of the Iran-Contra scandal? Yes, anti-aircraft missiles were sold to Iran. In one form or another, U.S. money has gone to just about every group in the Middle East. Whether it's been filtered through third parties or fourth parties is not the point. And when you involve yourself in the Middle East militarily, which we in the West do constantly all over the Middle East, the bad guys, if you want to put a sort of cliche name to them, will also benefit. Of course they will. It's not a clean-cut, black-and-white war we're fighting at. Forget words like, you know, justice and democracy. This is about power. And power is a very cynical commodity. And if you're going to go in and say, well, we're going to support the Senora government, fine. You're also going to have to support Senora's government supporters, which include the Druze. Walid Jumblatt is the leader of the Druze faith and the leader of the Druze people, and he's their warlord, if you like. Jumblatt's just been in Washington meeting U.S. government leaders. But during the Civil War, Jumblatt's militia carried out some of the most cruel, sadistic killings, mass killings of Christians, rape and murder and throat cutting, that's all now been forgotten. Everyone in Lebanon, with the exception of poor old Fouad Senora, the Prime Minister, whom I know well, just about everybody in Lebanon has blood on their hands, and they will all want a share of the money cake, and sure enough, they'll get it.
Our guest, Robert Fisk, foreign correspondent for the Independent, Mideast correspondent, I should say. You're listening to WILL AM 580. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Fryna, Illinois. You're on the air with Robert Fisk.
Hi. It's a great opportunity to talk to somebody that really knows the Middle East, I believe. I thought of something interesting here that a magician playing cards is basically in a no-win game because everybody would think he's either cheating or he's incompetent. And, you know, that's kind of an existential answer to that first caller. I've got an idea about, first a question. Can't the opium production be stopped? I mean, seriously, the troops and the international NATO and the other people that are there, you can't tell me they don't know exactly where and what's being grown, okay? And then the standard answer is, oh well, the farmers can't make money any other way. Well, what about subsidizing medical marijuana to the world market for that, which would at the same time undercut the narco traffickers? Just as an idea. Also, two or three other things. This Australian citizen is going to be the first detainee to go on trial at Gitmo for aiding the Taliban. Now, didn't Bush give the Taliban $42 million in May of 2001 to stop opium? And then 12 days before 9/11, the Taliban government apparently authorized the opium growers to go ahead and plant again. Well, wow, you know? Just one other thing. The Pentagon budget is obscene, and that's an underreported story. The Military Commissions Act is an underreported damage to the U.S., and just Bush should be impeached, period. Thank you, and I'd like to hear a response. Thank you.
I think there's a lot in there, but I think in particular the discussion of the opium trade and U.S.-Taliban relations are things you could comment upon.
I think the Pentagon budget and the impeachment or non-impeachment of your president is your problem, not mine. Look, the opium trade has been going on out of the Middle East and out of those particular region of Southwest Asia for centuries. There's nothing new in it. And the idea that we can go in there and plow up the fields, spray them with chemicals, and leave the farmers broken, poverty-stricken is not on. Basically, what's happening is that every time we try to go and get rid of the opium fields, the Taliban come along and say, support us and we'll stop them burning your fields. And that's one way in which the Taliban get support against NATO. And, of course, it's very effective because if you're an opium farmer, why should you lose your income? You have to have family to look after, an extended family. You have people to look after. It's your land. It's something that you own. Therefore, the opium farmers are not going to sit around being worried about crack on the streets of New York. That's a faraway place any more than people here are terribly worried about the farmers of Afghanistan. It's been suggested many times that subsidized medical products from opium is one way to get around this whole issue. In other words, let them grow the opium and use it in legitimate and legalized ways. But I think it's on such a scale now. I mean, after all, Afghanistan, remember, is now producing more drugs per capita today than it did before the U.S. Destruction of the Taliban government. Indeed, for a long time, you know, the Taliban did themselves ban all drug production in Afghanistan. I was traveling in Afghanistan during the Taliban period, and there were whole sections of the country where the farmers were instructed under Islamic tenets to get rid of the opium, and many of them did, not all, but many of them. But now, you see, one of the problems is that in order to prop up the government, which we are subsidizing and supporting, the democratically elected government of Karzai, etc., he needs warlords to support him, and the warlords make their money from opium. So it goes round and round in circles. I don't think the war on drugs is any more sensible than the war on terror. Who's ever heard of a war on an abstract noun, for heaven's sake? We've never seen that before. Somehow we have to get around this. Yes, you can subsidize the farmers, you can give them other crops to grow, and then add to that money which would equal what they would earn had they grown opium. But this has to be done on a quite different scale to what we're talking about now. You can't go in with the Canadian Patricia's Light Own or the U.S. Marines or the British Grenadiers or the Black Watch and start shooting it out with the Taliban and rushing around to the farmers saying, oh, by the way, if you just stop growing opium, we'll really give you some more money and some potato seeds. It's not going to work like that. Where we went wrong in Afghanistan is at the very beginning after the fall of the Taliban, we, together hopefully with Muslim armies, if they could have gone there, should have hoovered up every weapon in that country and disarmed it. Every weapon, including those of the warlords. But we didn't do that because particularly U.S. special forces needed the warlords to do their fighting for them. So no one took the guns away. The warlords, people like Dostum in the north, for example, remained powerful and ruthless and vicious and still there. And these people will also oppose us if we try to crack down on their, that's a great phrase, crack down, if we try to destroy their opium markets, or at least what they cream off from the profits. So it's to use that old phrase, it's a no-win situation. Either we really want to turn to the Afghans and produce a country whose economy works, or we say, look, you know, we can pour money in, we can do our best, but it's the Afghans who have to make the decisions. But when you have a situation where, as your listener quite rightly said, at one point we were quite happy to negotiate with the Taliban. You know, a Taliban delegation actually came to the United States to discuss a gas pipeline that would run across Afghanistan. It's not by chance, I think, and it was an Israeli newspaper that spotted this very shrewdly, that all the major American bases in Afghanistan today are not in defensive positions. They're on the route of the proposed gas pipeline, which the Taliban originally were prepared to go along with from the former Soviet Muslim republics down to Pakistan. So, you know, there's a whole lot of wheels within wheels here. It isn't a simple case of what do we do with the opium farmers. I don't think you can actually just go across and just soak Afghanistan in chemicals and get rid of the opium crop. It'll come back. It'll return. Or it'll move across borders into other countries. And I think that it needs a much bigger social picture of Afghanistan. Maybe we have to chop Afghanistan in half and say that the bottom bit becomes Pashtunistan because they're Pashtun people and the top bit is Afghanistan. I don't know. But the Afghans will have to do that. We do enough border drawing on our own. But I think your listener is quite right. It is a major issue. And I think that, you know, I must say I thought it was a bright idea when the first ideas came up internationally that perhaps the opium crop production could be turned into a medicinal industry, if you like. But again, nothing ever happened of that. And one of the big problems you see in Afghanistan at the moment is you have all these various UN officials and NGOs and government, non-governmental organizations with various projects. And for the reasons of their own career advancement, the officials will always tell you things are getting better, things are going to work, even if on the ground they clearly don't work. And I don't think we have much power over the southern part of Afghanistan. Now, when our soldiers can't even go to the center of Kandahar, the largest city in the south, how on earth can they wipe out an opium production system?
Robert Fisk, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of callers wanting to speak to the Mideast correspondent for The Independent, who's in the United States for a brief trip. So we're fortunate to have him on the air. Before we go back to the phone lines, Robert Fisk, I do have a question. You referred earlier to the U.S. relationship to Israel and what a central relationship that is to understand Middle Eastern politics. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more? What in your view is sort of the Israeli vision such that it is for that region? And is there a way that Israel and its neighbors can coexist peacefully?
Well, you know, you can come at this from four or five different angles, and we don't have the time for even one of them, I suspect. Look, the problem is that as long as America regards Israel as its closest ally in the region and is prepared, right or wrong, to support what Israel does, there can never be an American-engineered peace in the Middle East. We can talk about peace processes, roadmaps, putting things back on track, Oslo agreements. It won't work. And as long as ultimately the Americans play the role of saying, well, we support Israel, but we want peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but it's up to the parties concerned to make the tough decisions, then you're basically saying, well, an occupying power, Israel, is going to dictate the terms to the occupied, the Palestinians. You may, on the short term, be able to draw up documents of peace, but they won't work. At the end of the day, you see, at the kernel of the whole thing is UN Security Council Resolution 242, which calls for the withdrawal of Israeli troops from territories occupied by the Israeli army during the 1967 war. That includes Gaza, from which they've largely gone, but have gone back in again, the West Bank, Golan. And although other countries in the region, particularly Iraq, have always had to abide by UN Security Council resolutions or get bombed, Israel has not abided by that resolution. Indeed, it continues to expand settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land, and that is not the way to get peace. You know, there are many Israelis, not I think a majority, but many hundreds of thousands of Israelis who would like to get out of the occupied territories, out of the West Bank, even out of Golan, and say, look, if we could have sufficient security along the international border, internationally recognized border of Israel, we'd be content. But there is also a highly expansionist element to the Israeli government, which wants to thicken and advance the number of settlements, colonies, as I say, for Jews and Jews only on Arab land. And President Bush goes along with that. And as long as that is the case, and UN Security Council Resolution 242 is not abided by, we're not going to see a peace there. And thus, the Americans will always seem, or always be regarded by Arabs as being on the side of an expansionist power, i.e. Israel. Now, one would have to say that when the Israeli argument on 242 is that it doesn't say Israel must leave all the territories it occupied in 1967. It only says territories. But the resolution also says that it is illegal to take territory through war, which means that those settlements remain illegal under international law. And I think unless we have a situation where the United States supports a just solution, and that is to say an Israel inside the internationally recognized borders of Israel, or the 67 borders pre-war, then I don't think we're going to see a peace, and I don't think America will be respected as a middle man, a negotiator, someone who can negotiate fairly between the Arabs and the Israelis. It doesn't matter how many times you say, well, the Palestinians have used suicide bombers, they've been allied to terrorists. The word terrorist has become almost meaningless in the Middle East context now. At the end of the day, if you take someone else's land and you want to keep it, you will not have peace. And if the Palestinians were doing the same the other way around, and of course I know there are Palestinians who still want all of Israel back as Palestine and don't want any Jews living in Israel, not as many as are made out, but they do exist, of course, we're not going to come to any kind of resolution. We can't solve the Middle East. We crucified the Middle East after the First World War by chopping it up into these little artificial statelets, but at least we can find resolution. But at the moment, I have to say, with the destruction of Iraq, with Afghanistan crumbling, with all our regional wars in bits, I don't see any peace coming. I think it's an extremely pessimistic situation. I get up every morning, I live on the seafront in Beirut, and I hear the sea washing on the rocks below my home and the wind in the palm trees, and I wake up in the morning and I say, where is the explosion coming today? Bali, London, New York, West Bank, Tel Aviv, Iraq. It's impossible to exaggerate the extent of the tragedy which is now cloaking that region, and in which we, of course, are partly responsible. We are there. They are not here, to put that other, to remind us again of who's occupying who.
Our guest, Robert Fisk, you're listening to Media Matters. We have four very patient callers who have been waiting to speak with Robert Fisk on the lines here at Media Matters. Let's go to those phone lines now. Let me ask each caller to be as brief as possible so we can get to all the callers. Line 1, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Robert Fisk.
Good afternoon. On February the 28th, the Asia Times online paper ran an article with a headline, U.S.'s Iraq oil grab is a done deal. And the article then went on to talk about the draft law on dividing up oil revenue and how the World Bank and Paul Wolfowitz is involved in major American oil companies and other international companies, too. But the thrust of the article was, this is the reason we're there, this is why we've done this fight, and this is what's at stake. And I guess I would criticize so many journalists for really not taking up on this story and following it. You've mentioned now about a pipeline through Afghanistan. I think there's really three pipelines through Afghanistan.
There are none at the moment, of course.
And Iraq has the, you know, world's second largest known reserve of oil. And if it's not about oil, you know, I mean, you say it's power. Well, it's about money. It's about controlling the oil wealth. And I'll hang up and let you have at it. Thank you.
Well,
thank you, caller.
There's a listener of judgment and sensitivity. Yeah, of course it's about oil. Look, if the major export product of Iraq was asparagus or carrots or potatoes, do you really believe the 82nd Airborne would be in Iraq? Do you think the U.S. Marines would be in Anbar province? No, they would not. Of course it's about oil. It's interesting that the first major proposal from the insurgent side, from one of the largest insurgent groups on the Sunni side, for talks with the Americans. They've actually proposed talks with U.S. officials, with the U.S. ambassador, Khalilzad, and also with a senior U.S. commander. This was passed on to my paper, The Independent. We published this on our front page. One of the first items on the agenda for talks for American withdrawal from the insurgents themselves in Iraq. And remember, all wars end when we do talk to the insurgents. We did in Vietnam, the French did in Algeria. One of the first items is that the control of the oil wealth of Iraq must return to the Iraqi people. And I think ultimately that is almost certainly what will happen. There were other demands by the insurgents, like America has to disown the present Iraqi government, which of course they're not going to do. But then again, the FLN insurgents in Algeria began with similarly unrealistic demands of the French, and in the end there was a deal done, as there will eventually have to be done between the insurgents and the Americans. I'm sure that the control of oil will be at the center of that. It's interesting that when the French wanted to bargain with the insurgents in Algeria, they said, you can have independence, but we want to keep control of southern Algeria, to keep control of the gas fields and also use it as a testing site for nuclear weapons. And the Algerians said, no, you get out of our country. And that, I imagine, is what the Iraqis will ultimately say in some form of unified form to the United States. And I don't think that the grab for oil will actually have worked. But yes, I entirely agree with your listener. I think that the way in which that was managed, the way in which laws were introduced by Paul Bremer III, deliberately, in effect, to put the oil up for Western markets to take, was underplayed by the press. They didn't go after it strongly enough. We did on The Independent. We knew what was happening. There was a particular press conference Bremer held in Amman that was very revealing, where he basically said it's going to be Walmart. But most newspapers did not, because, as we know, your major mainstream, I don't like that word, papers, the Times, the Post, the LA Times, they went along for many, many months, indeed several years, after the invasion and occupation of Iraq, still mouthing the same old stuff from the U.S. administration. American sources say, American officials say, U.S. intelligence officials say, even after the total discrediting of the stories about weapons of mass destruction and links between Saddam and al-Qaeda. But yeah, look, it is primarily about oil. Of course it is. You know, it's not about asparagus, is it?
Robert Fisk, what about the issue of military bases, permanent bases in Iraq for U.S. forces to sort of be a center of U.S. Geopolitical power in the region?
Yeah.
Do you think the United States will have any way of keeping those bases in the future?
Well, they're still expanding them. Balad, for example, is virtually an American city. But I don't think any serious Iraqi insurgent force that emerges, and I mean, obviously, at the end, they're all going to have to become one unit. You can't negotiate with 15 different insurgencies. And we're not talking about al-Qaeda. That's a glom on. The Iraqis will have to deal with al-Qaeda. We can't do that in Iraq. Eventually, I think, any serious political force which negotiates for an American withdrawal will not allow those bases to remain. These are the bases which, of course, you remember Donald Rumsfeld famously called lily pads. They don't look like lily pads. They look like crusader castles. And, of course, the other thing about this whole system is that it's getting very difficult to resupply these huge fortresses. If you go in a helicopter, you can be shot down. In some cases, you can land four-engined aircraft on the airstrips built, for example, in Balad. But are you going to permanently resupply these isolated bases in the way that the Crusaders resupplied their castles in the 12th century? I don't think you can do that. So I think they will become uneconomical. I think at the end of the day, you see, and this is coming way, way back from the grains of sand, we must have a mature relationship with the Middle East. Whatever the religion of the people who live there, whatever their politics may be, whatever their aspirations may be, we need to have a mature relationship which is not based on the placement of our fortresses, our Abrams M1 A1 tanks, our Bradley fighting armored vehicles, our Humvees, our Apache helicopters, etc., etc. We need a different form of relationship with the Middle East. And at the moment, we're not prepared to do that. You know, the Arabs would like, as I always say, some of our democracy, but they also want freedom from us. And this we do not intend to give them. And oil is part of the answer to that question.
Our guest, Robert Fisk, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. 1 week from today, our guest, fittingly enough, will be Chalmers Johnson, talking about his brand new book, Nemesis. So please join us in 167 hours. But we do have a few minutes left with Robert Fisk, the Mideast correspondent for The Independent, who's in the United States, to give a talk this evening in New York City at Town Hall on 43rd Street. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Robert Fisk, and thank you for your patience.
Yes, thank you so much for all your information. I wanted to know, from your perspective, what do you see of this big meeting in Baghdad with all of the countries coming in that Condi Rice magically pulled out of her hat last week? So I'll let you talk about that. Thanks.
Yeah, well, you know, the Syrians have been waiting and have been saying repeatedly that they're waiting to be involved in such talks. And the Iranians have always been prepared to do so. The Iranians and the Syrians haven't been refusing to talk about Iraq or try and help. It's the Americans who've been refusing. I mean, the American government, not American people, who've been refusing to talk to Iran and Syria. Suddenly they realize, and I wrote in the paper 6 months ago that this would probably happen, that they've got to talk to Iraq and Syria if they want to get out. Otherwise, they will not be able to get out without a lot of bloodshed. And then that will, of course, be extremely humiliating, both for the United States as a superpower and for all the regional friends of America, whether they be, you know, Mubarak in Egypt, King Abdullah of Jordan, and so on, the Turks. And I think ultimately what we're seeing is the very beginning of some form of ceasefire talks, but it's got a long way to go. And eventually, I'm sure, as I said earlier, the insurgents will demand that the Iraqi government is no longer part of those talks. They want to talk directly with the U.S. forces as an occupying force. And the insurgents, both Shiites and Sunnis, are going to say, we are the representative of the people of Iraq because we fought for the freedom of the country. And the government, however democratically elected, went along with what the Americans want. But yes, I think these talks are fascinating. I'll be interested to see if they actually happen. And what will be particularly important is to see how senior the officials are coming from Damascus and Tehran. If they're junior officials, or if they're senior and the Americans send a few low-grade State Department people, then we still have a long way to go.
Our guest, Robert Fisk, let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. Some time ago, I listened to this chilling document by a conversation between Aaron Russo and Alex Jones, where they basically had a conclusion that all this oil wars or wars for oil was a machination of something they called the Council for Foreign Relations. Basically a bunch of people trying to rule all the natural resources on Earth. So can you comment on that if you have a slight idea on what I'm talking about? Thanks.
I'm not familiar with this document, I'm afraid. You realize that the odd situation I'm in is that I see that I live in Beirut and based in Beirut and travel around the Middle East, and I tend to see the world looking outwards, not the world from here looking in. Although when I'm in New York, of course, I look through the other side of the glass darkly and see a different kind of Middle East. look, I don't believe in global conspiracies, although whenever I tell an Arab that conspiracy theorists are out of their minds, they will remind me quite accurately that the CIA and the British MI6 overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh government in Iran in the 1950s, which is absolutely true. We did. And there's all kinds of skullduggery which we Westerners perform in the Middle East, which we deny at the time, which the papers don't cover, and later on it all turns out to be true. I rather think, you see, that in terms of oil, if the Arabs were able to have some kind of unified voice or unified ideas, they could easily deal with the major Western oil companies, which use, frankly, governments, particularly the American government, to get concessions, which otherwise, in a free market, they wouldn't be able to obtain. On the other hand, global conspiracies are difficult to support. It's like the people who believe that the U.S. administration has some hand in 9/11. I think that's absolute rubbish. There's a lot of secrets about 9/11, but with the Bush administration, which has screwed up everything it's ever done in the Middle East, I don't think they could successfully bring off that particular atrocity. But, you know, I think that you need to step back a little bit and realize that, first of all, oil as a commodity is not going to last forever, and the Arabs know that. But with an enormous political immaturity, they're not really able to deal with this. Some Arab states, for example, are clearly investing, Saudi Arabia to some extent, Kuwait certainly, United Arab Emirates and Qatar definitely, for the day when that oil goes. But I think there's no doubt that the major automotive industries in the United States and other parts of the world are hoping that the oil fuels continue. That's why Iraq is so important. Indeed, it may have not just the second largest reserves in the world. It may indeed have the greatest oil reserves in the world. I think as long as that oil is in the ground, the Middle East will be our playpen, and we will continue to use fossil-burning fuels, and to hell with global warming. That's not my view. That's what I think will be the industry's attitude. But in terms of the actual Middle East, I don't think that the world's oil companies control the Middle East oil. They would like to, but I don't think they do. The problem is that no one really controls it, and the Arabs, who should be able to say, look, this is our land, our property, don't do so. And when we invade a country like Iraq, and take that oil from them, you can see the problem.
Our guest is Robert Fisk. You're listening to Media Matters. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Line 4, Robert from San Francisco, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just sorry to hear Robert Fisk say that he doesn't give much credence to so-called conspiracy theories. My question in particular was to ask him about what his opinion is about blowback. And personally, I feel it's been an overly beguiling idea that gives the Bush administration rein to pursue its objectives. But I just would add one other thing, and that is I was curious what indeed Robert Fisk has learned since his last trip here. Has he looked at some of the information available about the so-called truth of 9/11? I wish he would comment on that, and I hope he reconsiders his opinions, just as he has Seymour Hersh's opinion about the invasion of Iraq. Thank you.
Yeah, well,
Thank you very much, I don't have
a lot of time to answer that. Look, I do believe in conspiracy theories because, as I just said, example, Mossadegh, they have happened and they have had the results that the plotters wanted. They do exist, yes. My overall point, though, about 9/11, I mean, first of all, you've got to understand, I'm a Middle East correspondent. I have the whole Middle East to cover. I do not cover New York, Washington, etc. I have met bin Laden three times, and I've talked to a lot of people around bin Laden, and I do believe he was involved in 9/11, what exactly that involvement was, and with a secretive administration like you have here in Washington, the most secretive administration since World War II, I can understand why people come to believe that there is some sinister conspiracy behind it. I can't investigate it. I have at least 32 countries to cover, and the United States is not one of them. All I will say and repeat to you is that a Bush administration, which has totally screwed up every single policy it's had in the Middle East, whether it be Israeli-Palestinian peace, Iraq, Afghanistan, relations with the Arabs, etc., which has been able to so infuriate the entire Islamic world, is it really possible, is it capable of successfully carrying out 9/11? I think the answer has got to be no. And anyone who steps back and looks at the folly of the Bush administration would have to say the same. 9/11 was an infinitely complex, carefully coordinated international crime against humanity. I don't think the Bush administration is capable of getting close to that.
Robert Fisk, we've only got about a minute left, and I'd like you, for a second, if you would, if you're comfortable talking about this, discuss Britain's relationship to the United States and Middle East policy. It's been obviously a very close relationship over the past several years. Is this becoming a politically contentious issue in Britain?
Not to say the least. I don't think there's been a close relationship between Britain and the United States government. There's been a very close relationship between a man called Tony Blair and the United States government. You know, most Brits and most Americans like each other very much, and that goes for me. But my goodness, why Blair, who was elected as a socialist, would want to constantly be such a dog to the U.S. administration, especially when he's treated with such humiliation by Bush and his colleagues, is a complete mystery to many of us in Britain. I think what happened, you know, is that Blair began to believe he was Winston Churchill, which he definitely isn't, and nor is Mr. Bush, by the way, though they've both aspired to that role. And Blair began to think he was a great statesman and a great thinker. That's why he keeps saying, you know, I absolutely and completely believe that I'm right. In other words, if he thinks he's right, there's no problem. That doesn't mean he is right, however. I think that it is a most contentious issue. It has turned many more Britons against the U.S. administration than would have turned against it had Blair had a genuinely independent policy and not followed and sent our soldiers into death traps on behalf of Mr. Bush. But yeah, it is the principal reason, frankly, why Blair is leaving the prime ministership this summer, just as it is the same reason why the Spanish government lost power, why the Italian government of Berlusconi lost power, and why, indeed, John Howard's government in Australia may soon lose power.
On that note, unfortunately, I fear we're running out of time.
There you go.
Robert Fisk, Mideast correspondent for The Independent, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank Camilla Kovacs, my producer this week, for sitting in and doing a terrific job. I'm Bob McChesney. I will be back in 167 hours with Chalmers Thompson here at Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Thank you very much.